Senior IRGC commander warns that if Israel takes any action against Iranian nuclear sites, the regime will face a more powerful response in kind. Iran rejects Israel's allegation about damaging the Dimona nuclear plant during its recent punitive operation, calling it part of the regime's psychological warfare. The Iranian foreign minister says Tehran will make Israel regret any new attack on the country after Iran's punitive operation against the regime. Thank you for joining us. Iran has warned that in case of an Israeli military attack on the country's nuclear facilities, it will give a response in kind to the regime's aggression.
اگر هر گونه تهدیدی به اقدامی از سوی رژیم جعلی صهیونیستی علیه تأسیسات هسته‌ای کشور به وقوع پیوندد، امکان مقابل به مصر با استفاده از سلاح‌های پیشرفته وجود خواهد داشت. و قطعاً مراکز هسته‌ای رژیم مورد تهاجم و عملیات قرار خواهد گرفت. همطور
که احمد حق طلب is the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard's core unit that is responsible for safeguarding Iran's nuclear sites. He said Iran has identified all Israeli nuclear sites and powerful Iranian missiles are ready to destroy specified targets at any moment. Haqtalab added that Iran might reconsider its nuclear doctrine and policies in case of any Israeli aggression against its nuclear facilities. He said Iran has always had the power to attack regime's nuclear bases, but has remained committed to the international regulations that prohibit such attacks. Haqtalab stressed, as a leader of the Islamic Revolution has said before, the days of hit and run are over for Israel. He noted that in case of an Israeli strike on Iran, the country's response will be powerful and destructive. Meanwhile, the spokesman for Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has rejected Israel's allegation about damage to the Dimona nuclear plant during Israel's recent punitive operation. Brigadier General Ramzan Sharif says the claim is part of the regime's psychological warfare. Sharif added that the Dimona power plant was not amongst targets of Iran's retaliatory operation. He said the regime's allegation was nothing but a big lie which is aimed at deceiving the public opinion. His remarks came after Israeli media claimed that at least one missile has hit a building in the Dimona plant during the Iranian operation. The regime has threatened to give a response to Iran's retaliatory operation, which hit its military bases. Iran has vowed to respond in kind to any Israeli attack on its nuclear sites. Breaking news coming in that the explosion was hit near Iran's central city of Isfahan, but the reason is still unknown. We'll keep you updated as we go along. Now, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has warned that Tehran will make Israel regret any new attack on the country after Iran's punitive operation against the regime.
Iran's legitimate defense and countermeasures have been concluded. Therefore, the Israeli regime, the terrorist Israeli regime, must be compelled to stop any further military adventurism against our interests. Certainly, in case of any use of force by the Israeli regime and of violating our sovereignty, the Islamic Republic of Iran will not hesitate a bit to assert its inherent right to give a decisive and proper response to it to make the regime regret its actions.
Amir Abdollahian was addressing a UN Security Council meeting on tensions in West Asia. He said Tehran's punitive attack on Israel was a minimal and limited operation in accordance with Iran's legitimate right to self-defense. He also slammed Western countries for their efforts to prevent the UN Security Council from condemning Israel's attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus. Iran's top diplomat underlined Tehran's prominent role in securing stability in the region, saying Iran will continue its efforts in this regard. As for the situation in Gaza, Amir Abdullahian called on the UN Security Council to bring Israel and its allies to justice for committing genocide in the besieged Palestinian territory. He said Israel is an occupying regime and the passage of time will not give it legitimacy. Yemen's Ansarullah leader says Iran's retaliatory attack on Israel has changed the long-standing equation of the regime's hit-and-run strategy.
The operation, when it comes to its importance, it is that it established the equation of responding to the Israeli enemy at the time where the enemy and its partners were striving to establish the equation of invading or attacking in the Arab world and elsewhere. The Israeli enemy for tens of years got used to striking Arab countries, countries of Muslims, and not to receive any retaliation. This happened. It happened in Iraq, it happened in Sudan, it happened in various Arab countries. The Israeli enemy would strike targets for tens of years, and no one would dare retaliate militarily. Most of the time, sometimes there would be a complaint to the UN or to the Security Council. So establishing the equation of a strong military response, this is something very important at the time where the enemy wants to preserve the equation of being allowed to attack, whereby all of the Islamic Ummah, all the countries in the Arab world and elsewhere would be open for attack for the Israeli enemy, whereby they could do anything they want without receiving any retaliation. Also establishing the rules of engagement. If they attack, there will be a strong response and a decisive response, and their aggression will not go unanswered. This is something very important. After the failure of the
enemies, their failure. Addressing the Yemeni people in a televised speech, Abdul Malik al-Houthi hailed the Iranian response to the Israeli attack on his embassy in Damascus. He said Israel and its Western allies tried to downplay the significance of the operation after failing to prevent Iran's response. Al-Houthi, without naming a specific country, condemned some Arab states for protecting Israel during Iran's operation. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Yemeni leader said his country will continue its operations in the Red and the Arabian Seas until a total ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The United States has blocked Palestine's full membership of the United Nations by casting its veto against a draft resolution on the subject. The draft resolution recommended that the state of Palestine be admitted to membership by the UN General Assembly. Britain and Switzerland abstained, while the remaining 12 council members voted in favor. The Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority strongly condemned the U.S. veto as unfair, unethical, and unjustifiable. It emphasized that the U.S. veto defies the will of the international community, which strongly supports Palestine's full membership in the UN. It added that Washington's policy on Palestine represents a blatant violation of international law and fosters Israel's campaign of aggression against Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Reacting to the U.S.'s veto, Palestine's UN envoy said membership in the world body is a necessary step towards reversing the historical injustice that has been inflicted on the Palestinian people.
The fact that this resolution did not pass will not break our will, and it will not defeat our determination. We will not stop in our effort. The state of Palestine is inevitable. It is real.
Mansour added that Palestinians will not stop their effort at full UN membership. He stressed that formation of the state of Palestine is inevitable. The Hamas resistance movement also condemned the U.S.'s veto in the strongest terms. It said Washington's support for the Zionist Nazi regime has made it more isolated amongst the international community. This was a second Palestinian attempt for UN membership and came as the Israeli regime's genocidal war on Gaza is in full swing. Palestine is currently a non-member observer state. Its full UN membership must be approved by the Security Council and then at least two-thirds of the General Assembly. Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Mark Weber, the director of the Institute for Historical Review. Mr. Weber, welcome. Mr. Weber, just a few hours ago, we saw that the U.S. vetoed against Palestine's bid for full U.N. membership, despite the majority, including the U.S.'s allies, South Korea, Japan, and France, voting in favor. Now, so basically, just one vote killed any hopes of that happening. For your initial thoughts on that, and do you think the U.S. Is now becoming more isolated in the international arena?
The answer is yes. This vote in the United Nations Security Council underscores just how out of step the Biden administration and the U.S. government is, not just with regard to the Middle East, but with regard to international policy in the broadest sense. It's important to remember that something like 140 countries around the world recognize the state of Palestine. The United States position is a bizarre one, a contradictory one. The U.S. position is that the Palestine-Israel conflict should be solved with the recognition of two states. The United States of America, however, recognizes one state, Israel. It does not recognize Palestine, unlike the majority of countries in the world that represent the overwhelming large population of the world. The U.S. position is that a recognition of a Palestinian state will depend on negotiations, as they say, between the United States and Israel. But that's ludicrous, because the Israeli government, and in fact emphatically the Netanyahu government in Israel, says it will never support a Palestinian state. So effectively, the United States is saying the decision about whether a Palestinian state should be recognized is up to Israel, not up to the people of Palestine, not up to the people of the world. And this vote only underscores America's lack of inability to be in line not only with public opinion increasingly here in the United States, but even everywhere around the world. And that's ironically enough, when the Biden administration took office, it announced that, in contrast to the Trump administration, the United States was once again going to lead the world. That's what Biden himself and the Secretary of State Blinken said. In fact, the United States is more out of line, more out of sync with the rest of the world than at any time, especially with the Middle East, but with other issues as well, than it has been for many, many years.
Mr. Weber, I've talked about this with our previous guests as well. I wanted your opinion as well. One of Iran's main issue with the embassy attack, which forced Iran to take action and answer back with a direct attack on or reprisal attack on Israel, was that the UN Security Council failed to even condemn Israel's deadly attack on Iran's embassy. Now, many are talking about the double standards and also the body's inability to function independently or to function at all sometimes, in some cases. Like we've seen that it hasn't been able to stop Israel's genocidal onslaught on Gaza. Even worse, it can't even make the regime allow humanitarian aid to the Strip. So what can be done to solve this problem?
This will not change as long as the enormous power of the organized Jewish community continues to hold American political life and much of cultural life in its grip. American politicians don't support Israel because they especially love Israel. They support Israel because it's to their advantage in their own careers and in political life in America to do so. And that has enormously skewed American policy so that it does not represent the authentic interests of the American people, and of course represent the interests of humanity. It represents the interests of those people who have a very strong hold and grip on American public life and American political life. But the remarkable thing, the important thing, though, is that this recognition of this reality is growing in the United States and around the world. And as long as, but America will continue its policy. There's not going to be a change until there's really a change in power structure here, you might say, here in the United States. And unfortunately, that's going to take some time or much more effort than is will be possible in the short run. But it's changing. There's no question. And public opinion polls reflect a real shift that's been taking place, especially since October 7th, 6th, when the beginning of this latest round of terrible violence.
Mr. Webb, how much has these demonstrations by the people around the world have had an impact on, let's say, the country's officials, the presidents, the high-ranking officials? Have they made any changes? Has it been any, let's say, fruitful up to now?
I don't think the demonstrations seem to matter much, and I don't think they will matter. What does matter, though, are that leaders around the world are telling the American president, you've got to stop this. You are showing an inability to restrain Israel, and of course American policy itself, but restrain Israel from carrying out measures that are not merely loathsome and horrifying to people around the world, but are contrary to very basic interests of people around the world and of governments. And that's, I think, especially what's playing a bigger role. Biden is hearing from leaders everywhere around the world, even from countries that are allied with the United States, even with countries that still verbally support the American position and support Israel. They're saying Israel's out of control. This is harmful for all of us. I mean, it's not just merely a question of sentiment or a question of morality or ethics. It's also a question increasingly of what's in the interests of the people that these governments are supposed to represent and of humanity.
Mr. Webber, thank you for your time, sir. There you have it, Mr. Mark Webber, Director of Institute for Historical Reviews. Thank you, Mr. Webber. Now, continuing with the rest of the news, the ongoing Israeli aggression has caused more deaths and destruction in the besieged Gaza Strip 196 days into the regime's genocidal war. Palestinian medical sources say at least 3 civilians were killed and dozens of others wounded in Israeli artillery shelling in central Gaza. To the south, in Rafah, nearly a dozen Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli bombing of a residential building. The fatalities include 5 children and 2 women from one family. Also in the north of the Strip, rescue workers have recovered the bodies of 30 people from the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital. The death toll from the Israeli genocide has now risen to nearly 34,000. Thousands of people are feared to be trapped under the rubble of their homes. Most of the victims of the US-backed onslaught are women and children. And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
A British government advisor on social cohesion has described attempts to portray protesters on pro-Palestinian marches as extremist and outrageous and dangerous. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. British ministers are considering proposals to ban MPs and councillors from engaging with groups such as the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, Extinction Rebellion, and Just Stop Oil. The plans put forward by the government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, say mainstream political leaders should tell their representatives to employ a zero-tolerance approach to groups that use disruptive tactics or fail to stop hate on marches. The British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, are due to discuss the proposals as part of a review conducted by Woodcock, the former Labour MP who now sits as Lord Walney, a crossbench peer. The Prime Minister was condemned by human rights groups for warning of forces trying to tear us apart during a hastily arranged address in Downing Street recently. He was charged with exaggerating tensions at protests after he warned of mob rule in Britain. In an article in the Sun newspaper, Lord Walney wrote, "My review on political violence is about to be formally submitted to the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary. In it, I'm asking the leader of every mainstream political party to take a zero-tolerance approach to the threat that is threatening our democracy." Lord Walney added, "So Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer should instruct their MPs and councillors not to engage with anyone from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign until they get their house in order and cut the hate from their marches." The proposals are politically convenient for the government because, if accepted, they would put further pressure on the Labour leader Keir Starmer over his party's stance on pro-Palestine demonstrations. Several sitting Labour MPs have attended Palestine Solidarity Campaign events, including the former Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, and the MP for Poplar and Limehouse, Apsana Begum. Labour has refused to suspend MPs who have attended events, despite demands from senior Tories, because the Palestine Solidarity Campaign is not a proscribed organisation. The Conservatives have previously engaged in talks with Extinction Rebellion, including the Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove, whose department is working on the definition of extremism as part of its brief. Ministers are looking at broadening the new definition to cover groups that officials claim their actions undermine the UK's institutions, as previously reported by The Guardian. While Environment Secretary in 2019, Michael Gove met Extinction Rebellion and said afterwards he shared their high ideals to tackle the climate crisis. Labour leader Keir Starmer is already under pressure to allow Labour representatives more freedom to condemn Israel's actions in Gaza. After George Galloway's emphatic by-election victory in Rochdale, where 18% of the population is Muslim. Many within the Labour Party believe it points to anger felt by Muslims over the party's position on Israel. A shadow frontbencher questioned whether the Labour leadership had gone far enough in dispelling false narratives on pro-Palestine marches. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. A British government advisor on social cohesion has described attempts to portray pro-Palestine protesters as extremists and dangerous and outrageous. Dame Sarah Khan, who is carrying out a review of the resilience of the UK's democracy for Michael Gove, said such claims risk further dividing the country. Hundreds of thousands of people have been regularly massing on the streets of London to protest against the bombardment of the Gaza Strip by the Israeli regime. The former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has described the demonstrations as hate marches, and the government's Commissioner for Counter-Extremism, Robin Simcox, wrote in the Daily Telegraph recently that London had been permitted to be turned into a no-go zone for Jews every weekend. Speaking to the Daily Mail, before Robin Simcox's comments were published, Dame Sarah Khan said she believed the United Kingdom had a problem with extremism, but that people should be careful in their language. Dame Sarah Khan, who was Simcox's predecessor as the government's counter-extremism commissioner, said, "I think it is really important that we don't conflate those protesters, somehow saying or portraying them as somehow as being all extremists." She added, "What I've been really uncomfortable with over the last couple of weeks is a kind of argument that they're extremists on these demonstrations. I think that's actually outrageous." Dame Sarah Khan was appointed as an independent advisor for social cohesion and resilience in 2022 and is expected to complete her review this month. The Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has not gone as far as some within the Conservative Party in criticising the marches in London, but he has recently warned against the protests. Jonathan Hall KC, the government's independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, warned, however, against attempts to curtail freedom of expression and freedom of assembly on the basis that it might make some parts of society unhappy. Every week, tens of thousands of pro-Palestinian demonstrators protest in Britain, condemning Israeli crimes in Gaza. Recently, hundreds of thousands of pro-Palestine protesters staged a fresh march against Israeli crimes in London, demanding a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The demonstration, which was organised by UK-based advocacy and Palestine action groups, was one of the biggest pro-Palestinian marches held in London. The procession followed the main roads in central London to reach the Israeli embassy. The protesters responded to calls for a third Global Action Day for Gaza, demanding world leaders take immediate action to stop the massacring of innocent civilians in Gaza. Demonstrators held placards reading "Ceasefire Now, Free Palestine, and stop the genocide." Around 1,500 police officers have been patrolling the area and are said to be keeping marchers away from the Israeli embassy in London. The British Law Enforcement Agency claimed A demonstrator who was seen in the crowd with a placard was arrested for inciting racial hatred. Police officers then made 10 further arrests during the incident at Hyde Park Corner, bringing the total number of those arrested to 11. A number of further restrictions are being implemented by police during the protest. Meanwhile, similar marches were also held in other major cities across Europe, calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio, old ladies from all around the world. Welcome back to your own program, Muslim Lady. This is Asma. I have the honor to be your host once again. Yes, welcome to your own program. As usual, we're going to talk about the issues that are related to all the women out there. And in today's episode, we have Sister Nahid with us to help us with the topics. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Assalamu alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. I'm so glad and pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you very much for being here. How are you doing?
Good. Everything is going okay.
So that's perfect. As we go through the Islamic heritage of all the ladies out there, then we could see some prominent ladies who have been a role model for all the independent women out there. Like, when it comes to Islam, many biased people might look at it as a kind of a religion that does not care too much about women, while it is just the reverse. Like, from the very beginning of the mission of our Prophet, peace be upon him, the role of women is so, so much highlighted. And the example is, for sure, Lady Khadija salamullah alayha. So before we get into some more of details, I would like to have some introduction upon this great lady.
You know, first, if I want to talk about the great women in Islam, and I really agree with the point that you mentioned, that sometimes our religion is labeled as the religion of not supporting women, mm-hmm. and the religion in which women are just being limited. Even historically speaking, our religion started from the time that women were being disrespected, and our Prophet,
women were killed girls just because they are girls.
Our Prophet who started this fight, although he faced too many disagreements
and adversaries and enemies,
one who started this fight. Mm-hmm. And but not going to the details of what ups and downs he has experienced in those years. Going to Lady Khadija, salamullah alayha, we can say that she was the first believer in our religion. She mm-hmm. was the first follower of Prophet. And not talking about even the Prophet's aspect, like being the Prophet and having the spirituality of God. She was the one who decided to be a real devoter for this religion. She was the one who defined devotion for us. She was the one who defined a sacrifice for this religion. She was the wealthiest woman in her own time, and she just decided. She had too many people who were just fighting to have her beside, but she was the one who decided to be in this religion, to follow this religion, to believe in our Prophet, and to live this way.
Exactly. And it's very interesting how much she has contributed to this religion. Like, even before the mission of the Prophet started, she was a great supporter to him, just because she found him this trustworthy man, this man who is already known for his honesty. So she picked him as the one she's going to support as her husband, and then she practiced whatever love she has confessed. Like to be a woman, to be a wife of a person who has got nothing, and then you be a wealthy woman, it's so difficult to actually practice whatever you have confessed.
While at the same time, that boy, that man is labeled as someone who is acting strangely in the society.
Yeah.
Like you're losing your own community, you're losing the support of too many people around you.
Exactly.
And at the same time, you choose to lose your wealth at the same time.
Yeah, you're doing all this in the name of Islam, actually.
Yeah.
Islam, which was not known too much by people of the era.
That is both surprising and at the same time giving you the vibe of being proud of this person.
Exactly. It's a matter of pride, really. She's such an inspirational woman.
Yeah.
For all the women out there, just imagine. Well, we'll talk about that after the break. Let's go for a short break and then we'd come back to see what's more. Yes, welcome back. You're listening to Muslim Lady. We're talking about the great lady, Lady Khadija Salamullah Alayha. And then, already, I guess everybody knows about the biography. Like, she was one of the wealthiest and richest women of her own time. And then she married the Prophet before him, actually starting his prophethood, just because he was the one who was known for his honesty and being such a trustworthy man. Then she married him, and after the prophethood of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has started, she became this great supporter to him with his soul and her money, of course.
The other aspect of her true nice personality is that she was in real love, you know. She was even there to teach us the true meaning of love. Like sometimes these days, sadly, we see the definition of love being changed. Like love for gaining something.
Exactly.
Love for achieving something. Love for being more successful, having living in a better class of society. But she was the one who went in the opposite way.
In today's life, actually, it is labeled as love, but what you see is more of a materialistic trait.
Exactly. It's just, it's a life being led by greed, by, I don't know, the seek of attention and these stuff. But she kind of changed the whole mindset. She started a revolution within girls and women, which was just being led by her. She was the one who was the leader.
The inspirational lady.
Yeah, exactly. She was the one who started this. She was the one who taught us the true meaning of love. Even though you're not going to achieve anything, you're not going to gain money. You're also, not only you're losing money, but also you're losing your community at the same time.
Exactly.
You're losing support of the other people at the same time. She changed this structure and kind of ruined the stereotypes around.
Exactly. There was a time in which the Prophet went through a hardship. Like, actually, there was different phases to that, but there was this hardship that they were gathered in a special place. So in that time, it was the hardest and the most difficult era of the time in which she was living with the Prophet. And then she lost actually everything.
Yeah, it's like...
And it's actually not lost. Maybe I have to rephrase my word. She actually
devoted
everything to him and gave away everything just for her religion and for the Prophet she trusted so much.
Yeah, it's just the case of the society's idea that we are repeating the word lose, but she was at the same time devoting everything for the sake of achieving something so beautiful called
And it was
Islam.
A sort of donation, actually. She was the starter of that. She was the one who started the whole story. And by the way, by mentioning her, the great thing about her is that she's not only the grandmother of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, like she is the grandmother of Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam, of Imam Hassan alayhi wasalam, and she is the mother of the daughter who's been the actually queen of all the ladies of the world. Like the daughter through which the entire existence of Ahlul Bayt has started. Like she is the root to whatever we have in our Islamic heritage. So these are really great stuff to be attributed to a woman.
Yeah.
Just imagine what a great and devoted lady she was to gain such a place and a status in her life, to be the mother of Lady Fatima salamullah alayha, and to be the grandmother of the kings of heaven.
You know, it's like she was the frontier of the good. She was the frontier of everything that happened, every nice thing that happened to us afterwards in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm saying she was the leader of women. She was the one who started this nice way of improvement for girls, women, and for especially Muslim women.
And as paradoxical as it might seem, for those people who accuse Islam of oppressing women, she was a great businesswoman of her own time. Like, she could actually work as a role model for all the ladies out there, like in the modern world. She was a virtuous woman and at the same time a great businesswoman.
Yeah. And an independent woman.
And independent, of course, yes. So she could actually work as a great role model, as a paragon of goodness, and at the same time as a lady who's independent and who's got a lot of people to worry about, to work for their benefit, actually, and a lot more.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
She's also the sign of independence for us. Like, she was the one who, at a time that girls were killed, nobody was respecting the girls.
Exactly.
She was out there to be independent. She was out there working and staying against all those beliefs mm-hmm. that you're a girl, you're not going to work, you're not going to be successful. And she achieved everything. And she, even in this case, even it's very nice that even not considering Islam, in the case of the social matters, she proved that women can be successful.
So if we want to outline what kind of messages the lifestyle of Lady Khadija salamullah alayha is going to convey to other women, what would you mention to us?
You know, not considering Islam at first, because she was already rich at the time that she decided to devote everything mm-hmm. to Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The first thing was that she was independent, and that independence and hard work was the first theme, was the first definition, was the first message to all of us that mm-hmm. we can be successful, we can work, and we can be independent. Afterwards, after the after her marriage with Prophet, we can see the very clear big message of devotion. She was being the devoter of her wealth, of her life, for the sake of a very beautiful thing called our religion.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was sacrifice. She was just sacrificing everything. It's so nice that she was sacrificing the as we previously mentioned, the support of the people around and the support of community for the sake of the improvement and for the sake of being the big leader of the of this religion, without even knowing that she was going to be the leader. You know,
exactly.
It's so hard. At that time, she knew nothing. She didn't know that she's gonna be a role model that thousands of years later,
just she did everything out of her devotion and commitment to the love she had. And
it's very nice that she, no one promised her that you're gonna be the prominent leader, you're gonna be talked about a lot in the future.
Exactly.
She expected nothing. She just worked. Studying about her just paves our way through learning a lot of things, the things that are sometimes not taken into account these days,
exactly.
the things that are disregarded these days.
I'm just saying that for years ago, like so many years ago and so many centuries ago, such a perfect lady lived among women in an era in which people did not care too much for the women's right. And then she was the role model for those stuff. At a time when nobody knew anything about such stuff, she was there and she actually contributed a lot to the realm of womanhood, to how you could be an independent, great woman and inspirational, and at the same time devote yourself to your own religion.
Yeah, and expect nothing, you know? We have too many motivational quotes that are saying, exactly, when you choose your way, close your eyes and just work and go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But thousands of years ago in our religion, we had this prominent woman who was closing her eyes, choosing her way, and following the good, following the thing
exactly
that she believed was going to be mm-hmm the right thing.
Closing her eyes actually to all the difficulties
yeah, exactly
that came
and
into
to
their way.
And to all people who were just disagreeing, trying mm-hmm to stop her from her belief and were trying to just mislead her.
Exactly. So, this is all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh no, I'm waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight.
In the United States, the Supreme Court is to examine the federal obstruction law that has been used to prosecute the former President Donald Trump and the January 6 rioters. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The fallout from the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol landed before the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday, 16th of April, when the justices convened to consider the scope of a federal obstruction statute used to prosecute those who breached the building, as well as former President Donald Trump. At the crux of the case, known as Fisher versus the United States, is whether federal prosecutors can apply a law passed in the wake of the Enron scandal, which makes it a crime to corruptly obstruct or impede an official proceeding, to the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol. Before the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol, prosecutors had never used the law in cases that did not involve evidence tampering, as the first provision of the measure prohibits altering, destroying, mutilating, or concealing a document. But since 6th of January 2021, it has been levied against more than 330 defendants who breached the building where Congress had convened in a joint session to tally states' electoral votes. It is also being used to prosecute former President Donald Trump, who pleaded not guilty to one count of obstructing Congress's counting of Electoral College votes, one count of conspiring to obstruct the proceeding, and two others brought against him by Special Counsel Jack Smith in Washington, D.C. last year. The outcome of the legal fight is being closely watched because of the possible ramifications for the charges against Donald Trump, which stem from this Jack Smith alleges was a multi-pronged scheme to overturn the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. If the Supreme Court sides with Fisher, Donald Trump could seek to have the two counts related to obstruction of an official proceeding dismissed. Trump's case has been paused for months as he seeks to have the charges dismissed on the grounds that he's entitled to presidential immunity. The Supreme Court will consider that issue next week. Separate from Trump, the obstruction dispute could also have repercussions for scores of January 6 defendants who have already been convicted of the offence or pleaded guilty. A decision finding prosecutors stretched the obstruction law too far could prompt bids for new trials or lighter sentences. One of those defendants, Joseph Fisher, brought the dispute currently before the Supreme Court after he was charged in a 7-count indictment in early 2021. Joseph Fisher, then a police officer in Pennsylvania, entered the Capitol building around 3:25 p.m. on 6th of January 2021. Prosecutors claimed he encouraged rioters to charge and ran into a line of police officers whilst yelling an obscenity. His lawyers, though, said Fisher was pushed by the crowd into a police line. Joseph Fisher was in the Capitol for less than 4 minutes, they told the court. Among the charges Fisher faced was assaulting a police officer, disorderly conduct, and corruptly obstructing, influencing, and impeding an official proceeding. Congress's certification of the Electoral College vote. The charge was enacted as part of the 2002 Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and violators face up to 20 years imprisonment. Fisher moved to dismiss the count. U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols granted his request, determining that nothing in the indictment alleged that Fisher took some action with respect to a document, record, or other object in order to obstruct the congressional proceedings. The Justice Department appealed Judge Nichols's ruling to the U.S. District Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, which ruled against Fisher in a divided decision last year. In the lead opinion, Judge Florence Pan acknowledged that outside of the January 6 cases, there was no precedent for using the obstruction statute to prosecute conduct like that of Joseph Fisher's. Still, she concluded, the district court was wrong to adopt a narrow interpretation of the law that limited its application to obstructive conduct involving a document or record. Judge Florence Pan noted that 14 of 15 district judges in Washington, D.C. adopted a broader reading of the statute and called the near unanimity striking. Key to the ruling was interpretation of the word otherwise, which Judge Pan wrote meant that the second of the provision of two sections applies to all forms of corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding outside of what is covered by the first section. Lawyers for Joseph Fisher asked the Supreme Court to review the Washington, D.C. Circuit's decision and agreed to do so last December. In court filings with the High Court, defense attorneys urged the justices to narrow the scope of the law, arguing it targets discrete acts intended to affect the availability of evidence used in an official proceeding. Congress, they said, intended to protect the integrity of investigations and evidence when lawmakers wrote the measure after the Enron scandal. The company's outside auditor, Arthur Anderson, was shown to have destroyed incriminating documents. The Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday, 16th of April, took up the first of two cases that could affect the criminal prosecution of former President Donald Trump for his efforts to overturn his election loss in 2020. Hundreds of charges stemming from the Capitol riot are also at stake. The Supreme Court justices are hearing arguments over the charge of obstruction of an official proceeding. That charge, stemming from a law passed in the aftermath of the Enron financial scandal more than two decades ago, has been brought against 330 people, according to the Justice Department. The Supreme Court will consider whether it can be used against those who disrupted Congress's certification of Joe Biden's 2020 presidential election victory over Donald Trump. The former president and presumptive Republican nominee for the 2024 Republican nomination is facing two charges in the case brought by special counsel Jack Smith in Washington that could be knocked out with a favorable ruling from the nation's highest court. Next week, the Supreme Court justices will hear arguments over whether Donald Trump has absolute immunity from prosecution in the case, a proposition that has so far been rejected by two lower courts. The first former U.S. president under indictment, Donald Trump, is on trial on hush money charges in New York and also has been charged with election interference in Georgia and with mishandling classified documents in Florida. In Tuesday, 16th of April's case, the court is hearing an appeal from Joseph Fisher, a former Pennsylvania police officer who has been indicted on seven counts, including obstruction, for his actions on 6th of January 2021, when a mob of Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building in a bid to keep Joe Biden, a Democrat, from taking the White House. Lawyers for Joseph Fisher argue that the charge doesn't cover his conduct. The obstruction charge, which carries up to 20 years behind bars, is among the most widely used felony charges brought in the massive federal prosecution following the deadly insurrection on 6th of January 2021.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.